reach out such faith.
Hello, podcast listeners. We're here at Rational Faith for another episode, and we are starting the first of many in a series called Seek Ye Out of the Best Podcasts. In this series, we follow the counsel found in Doctrine and Covenants, section 88, verse 118, by seeking out and studying the wisdom all around us in the form of electronic media, such as podcasts. We refer to the great science and wisdom around us as extra-canonical revelation for our consideration. And we affectionately refer to the dispensers of these truths as our extra-canonical prophets. In this episode, we study the ideas brought forward by social psychologist Jonathan Haidt. He has authored two popular books, The Happiness Hypothesis and The Righteous Mind. He's presented three TED Talks and has been interviewed and featured on many podcasts. The material he presents offers a new way to look at human nature, and in particular groups that may appear to be diametrically opposed, such as liberals and conservatives, or believers and non-believers. Many of the insights Jonathan has shared have wide application in Mormon discourse and help to promote productive dialogue. In the following discussion, we use terms like liberal, conservative, believer, atheist, and others. Please note that we do not attribute any particular value to these terms, but are attempting to use them descriptively. I think you'll enjoy our overview of Haidt's moral psychology and the application of those principles to Mormonism's specific issues at hand today. Some of these issues that we discuss include homosexuality and the modern feminist movement within Mormonism. There are many other insights and applications that we were not able to get to during our discussion, so as you listen, please note them, any thoughts that you have or reactions, and share them on the blog page at rationalfaith.com. On to the discussion.
So I've got a gang of the permabloggers here. Everybody say hi. Paul?
Hello.
Jeremy?
Hi.
Leah?
Hi.
Russell?
Greetings.
And Janan?
Hello, hello.
All right. So we've got a pretty big topic today. I believe it was Fiona Givens who talks about extra-canonical scripture, and we believe in extra-canonical prophets. Jared Anderson likes to think of Jonathan Haidt as an extra-canonical prophet because a lot of the things that he's saying and teaching just make a lot of sense. And so we've collected a bunch of links for all of the listeners to go and listen to other podcasts or watch other TED Talks where Jonathan Haidt will lay out his philosophy of how people think, whether they are conservative or liberal.
Sure. And, you know, what makes Jonathan Haidt significant in this regard is that he's willing to make more of an overture to dualism than, you know, a lot of social psychologists or any other kinds of psychologists are willing to do. You know, these days, you know, it's much more likely for, you know, for them to think, you know, I wouldn't quite say that determinism is chic, but rather that, you know, you don't accept that there are, you know, competing fundamental aspects of human nature. But Jonathan Haidt, he acknowledges that there in fact are, and you know, he points to a very old description, and that is Plato's chariot metaphor, and he says that Plato's charioteer, he had to control two different kinds of horses. You know, there's the horse that's on the right. You know, he's noble, he's upright, and he's regal, and, you know, he loves honor, modesty, all these kinds of things that we would typically attribute to, you know, self-control and discipline. And on the other, you know, you have, you know, the horse that is much more given to impulse. It's the wild part of, you know, of the human soul. And according to, you know, Jonathan Haidt, you know, to some degree, you know, we deal with this as well. And this is, the fact that he's using this metaphor at all is important because he says that it is through metaphors that we understand the world around us. And, you know, this is in line with some work done by another psychologist named Robert Sternberg. His book is called Love is a Story, where he says that we define love first and foremost by metaphors, not by data, not by information, not by truth claims, but by a story. You know, whether we compare love or human nature to a journey, to a road trip, to, you know, a comedy, or, you know, any number of things. And he says then that, or I mean, he cites David Hume, who says that, quote, reason is and ought only to be a slave to the passions. Now, Haidt's argument in regards to this, he's not necessarily agreeing with Hume, but he is saying that, you know, 9 times out of 10, the kinds of judgments that we make as, you know, human creatures have a lot more to do with something innate, you know, something so deeply inborn that we are generally not even aware of it. But yet, he says, even we tend to give these kinds of, you know, deeply inborn motivations rational explanations. So we think we're being rational, but we really aren't. You know, he wrote another paper called, you know, the Emotional Dog and the Rational Tail. And half the time, it's, you know, it's the emotions guiding reason rather than reasons guiding emotions. Or as he conceptualizes it in the happiness hypothesis, he said, you know, we think of ourselves as riding, you know, horses or riding elephants, but what ends up happening is the elephant is actually riding us. The elephant is telling us where to go.
But I think that's a great thing to keep in mind, because we often think that we ourselves are always rational, and or that we are mostly rational or whatever. But in fact, he's implying that, or he's saying that it's actually the other way around, that we're rarely rational, but we're mostly passionate beings.
Yes, and, you know, his work fits within a larger body of work just on the idea of disgust. You know, there have been a lot of, you know, theorists, anthropologists, psychologists who argue that what we are disgusted by defines us just as much as anything else. That in some ways, you know, the people who disgust us are the most important people in our lives, but we must keep them, as one said, downwind. Right? So they're important, yeah. But they're important by defining us through who we're not rather than who we are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the idea of disgust or having things that we find repugnant is really important, and that ties into his 5 or 6 moral foundations. And in one of the other podcasts that I listened to, I believe it was the Brian Callen one, who's a comedian, it's quite a good conversation, I think. He quotes Leon Cass, who wrote a paper called an article called "The Wisdom of Repugnance," and he says, "Shallow are the souls that have forgotten how to shudder." And so that shows one extreme, identifying certain behavior that we need to identify certain things as just flat out wrong, that we can't go libertine and just do whatever we want. So moving that way, Leah, could you go over the 5 moral foundations as found at Your Morals or moralfoundations.org?
Yes. So what you were just speaking to, that one he calls sanctity or degradation as the reverse, and that is the psychology of disgust. And the idea is that if we can avoid contamination, we can live a more elevated, noble life. So that's one of them. The other four, one is care and harm, which is the idea that when we see somebody else suffering or in pain, that we ought to care about that and address it. Then there's fairness or cheating, and he kind of defines this as both the idea of equality, but not just equality, also proportionality, because there are some people approach the idea of fairness differently. And then there is loyalty and betrayal, which is basically summed up in the whole one for all and all for one idea. So this is sacrificing for the greater good, patriotism and whatnot. And then there is authority and subversion. And this is just the idea that there should be a hierarchical structure in society to keep everything in order, and it also incorporates a respect for tradition. So that's it. Those are the five.
In some of these podcasts, you can tell that he's like on Being, he's speaking with Krista Tippett, but also there's a group there and they're able to ask him questions. And a lot of people that he talked with don't necessarily agree, or at least initially don't like this idea that there are five moral foundations that he's determined so far. As one question was on authority, where the person said, if the authority figure is Abraham Lincoln, then that's moral. But if the authority figure is Adolf Hitler, then it is immoral. So authority cannot be a moral foundation. Authority is an amoral thing. It really depends on what that authority figure is doing, because it's not necessarily good. And I think the point is, these five moral foundations, these guide us in how we think. They are all not necessarily good, or another way to say it is that we can use all of these five moral foundations to support our bad behavior.
One thing that he talks a lot about is conservative thought versus liberal thought. And one of the things he says is liberals are focused heavily on care and fairness, whereas conservative thought will incorporate all five moral values. And so it's not a good or bad. It's just a way of thinking about it, and people value some things more than others.
I had a thought on loyalty. I always thought of that being a characteristic of something that you wanted in a friend. But the more I think about it, loyalty, when is it – when do you want to be loyal to someone or something where it's damaging in a sense? Don't we want to do the more moral thing? Like if your wife asks you to do something that you feel is immoral, wouldn't you have to step over that line? I'm not going to do this because I'm loyal to you. I'm not going to do this. Does that make sense? Does loyalty become a bad thing?
I think, like I was saying, I think all of these can become a bad thing. Like loyalty to Hitler certainly turned out to be a bad thing, but loyalty to your spouse in the opportunity to be unfaithful is certainly I would consider a good thing. No, a metaphor he described it as, like, all five of these moral foundations are like the equalizer on a stereo, and some people like a bass heavy sound, some people like a more bright sound, and so they'll tune their moral foundations up and down based on their genetics, based on basically what they're endowed with, what they're blessed with from birth, and then based on their experience and their education.
I do like your allusion to Hitler, obviously, because, you know, the sooner we can evoke Godwin's law over the podcast, the happier I am. But I think it's important that when we conceptualize, like, Nazism, not merely as a political system, but that those who adhered to Nazi philosophy believed wholeheartedly that they were ascribing to a moral system. Like, to say that Nazism was completely amoral is really to mischaracterize it, because they thought of what they were doing. I mean, even like in the early years, especially from like 1928, you know, through the mid-1930s, they thought it as being perhaps the most moral system around. You know, it was, you know, those who belong to the cultured elite of Weimar Germany, they were the ones who were amoral, at least according to their perspective. So there was a real internal morality to Nazism.
Right. Yeah. And so the morals are are not inherently good or bad, but it's what we use to make choices or to qualify the choices that we've already made.
I think it's important to realize that where he got this moral foundation was from looking at different cultures and different people. I mean, these five moral foundations are just something we do. And there are five things that we do that will bind us together as communities and make us different from most animals. They're what make us human. So he isn't saying that this is the most important moral foundation or this isn't, but he's just describing what we are. Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, that makes perfect sense. And he in the TED Talks for sure, he points out that other animals that work together or appear to work together as groups are generally very small groups, or if they're large, like ants, they're related. They're siblings. And so humans are unique in that we can build these huge civilizations and have extremely high cooperative effort relative to other animals. And the way that I guess he's tried to put this together is by these moral foundations.
He also notes that it both binds us and it blinds us. So yeah, the Nazis would be a moral system only because they're blind to all the things that may be unjust going on to anyone outside the group or even within the group sometimes. So the moral foundations aren't necessarily good or bad. They just help us to function together in one unit.
And Jeremy, you had brought up an idea where you've noticed sort of a cycle in history where these different moral foundations seem to be traded back and forth. Do you want to illustrate that a little bit?
Well, yeah, this is just going back to the idea of the difference between conservatives and liberals. How, you know, when a religion starts, it starts with some kind of new idea. Mormons, I guess the way they would visualize it is you get a prophet or a Moses or Christ figure, and they teach something new that really strikes people and unites them morally, and then immediately after you get that charismatic starter, you get people who want to preserve their teachings, and so they preserve those teachings using in-group loyalty, sanctity, authority, and they're the glue that preserves those teachings and moves them through time. But it seems, at least reading through the scriptures, over time, they start to not become sanctimonious, create new rules, start having haves and have-nots. And so every once in a while, a prophet will come by that is really big on the fairness and the caring for one another and tells them that, no, you guys, the children of Israel, all the prophets, all have in common this message of you need to care for the poor. There's something wrong with this society. And Christ himself, I think especially, he tried to bring things back on the rails, and then people took and preserved his teachings. And so you get this kind of apostasy and restoration almost over time. As far as an interplay between conservatives and liberals, where there's a push and a pull there, and I think both are important because the teachings, you aren't going to have a group bound without the conservatives, but without the liberals, things tend over time to become more and more legalistic and maybe more judgmental in that the care and fairness, every once in a while you need to inject some of that, but they also tend to be subversive technique sometimes. So.
Absolutely. And as I'm sitting here, I'm starting to think of some theological or other scriptural examples. Janan, as you're going over this, have you been able to put together a couple theological arguments for either the liberal exploration of boundaries, but there's also, it seems like there's theological arguments or scriptures that also support the conservative maintenance of those boundaries within our tradition and within other traditions. What have you thought about in along those lines?
Absolutely. So I think the examples of liberal interpretation of boundaries and conservative maintenance of said boundaries can be seen through the scope of care, fairness, and authority. I think one possible example that I feel is referenced most often is that idea of personal revelation and the spirit of prophecy. A scripture that's quoted oftentimes in terms of personal revelation is James 1:5. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God. I think it becomes very important in terms of a liberal interpretation as far as personal care. If you're looking at the different parts of morality, care, authority, etc. I think it's that establishing a personal care that sets it on the liberal end of the spectrum. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you have a more conservative view of the authority that is held by our leaders, as described in DNC 132.7. Also, another example I would say of more of a liberal interpretation would be prophetic infallibility. You have Joseph Smith saying a prophet was a prophet only when he was acting as such. And then on the opposite end, coming from more of an authoritative position, a quote from President Woodruff, the president of the church will never lead you astray, paraphrasing, of course. So you kind of have this yin and yang that exists within the church that even they're different, but they balance each other out.
And as I've thought about that, that very idea of prophet is only a prophet when speaking as a prophet, so that implies fallibility, and then the prophet, well, sure, he's not infallible. He is fallible, but he'll never really screw up big. That's sort of the latter is the conservative view, I would think, that has taken the authority figure and made that sacred. And so you don't question prophets because that is sacred. And more of the liberal viewpoint would say, well, it is sacred, but it's not that sacred, maybe. And so maybe we do need to question and keep things in check. And so it's interesting because they kind of keep each other, it seems like, from going off the rails too far. And so it shows, as I think about it, this sounds kind of like the body of Christ metaphor, where there are different parts that play different roles, yet they keep everybody together and they keep the work moving forward. Does anyone else have any other thoughts on this aspect broadly, as far as keeping groups together, keeping religions together?
Well, you know, one comment that Jonathan Haidt made once is that, you know, the human brain is not really wired to seek out truth. That's not our natural inclination. We are wired to play social games. Like, we're wired to think tribalistically, first and foremost. And that ends up defining and coloring our pursuit for truth. So Haidt would argue that, you know, as far as religions go, that, you know, religion is yet another manifestation of this, you know, deeply embedded impulse to form groups And, you know, we just so happen to use, in the case of Mormonism, you know, we happen to use the language of Joseph Smith and, you know, the symbology of temple worship in Moroni. But at the end of the day, all it comes down to is, you know, kind of an almost caveman-like instinct, you know, to create an enclave of people, because that's how mankind survives best, is by forming these clans and tribes.
And I would even argue that that's how humans progress as well. They not only survive, but they progress and improve by creating these groups where ideas can be shared, where education from prior generations or the experience from prior generations can be passed on to the group so that the group can continue to move forward.
And, you know, Haidt makes an interesting comment to this end. He says that, you know, evolution does a very poor job of anticipating the future. Of seeing what's yet to come. So, you know, it's, you know, I agree with you that, you know, forming groups is, in fact, you know, the best way to navigate the world. But sometimes I wonder, you know, how much progress that ultimately results in. I don't know. That's not a question I have the answer to. But, you know, if Haidt is correct in this, then this groupish, clannish impulse can lead in any number of different directions.
Well, I don't know if I have the answer either, but it's something interesting to think about.
Well, I'm just, you know, looking at the conservative and the yin-yang of the conservative liberal spectrum. I think it shows, I like that body of Christ analogy, because there is a tendency for one group to look polarized from the other, and were all the liberals to pull out of the church, then I think that legalistic tendency that with the less care, the fairness, the less openness to new ideas would cement faster. So it's, maybe it's self-serving, but it just goes to show that the church needs us. And we need them.
What I kept thinking while I was studying the TED Talks and the podcasts in preparation for this was just the idea that we know that our brains will reject data that conflicts with our core belief systems. And I just kept thinking about how everything that Haidt says supports that. And I, one of you already referred to this, just the fact that we are social creatures before we are logical creatures or before we care about what facts are. Part of me feels a little bit discouraged that maybe everything I've ever felt really sure about is something that my head made up so that I could be comfortable with what I already believed. Anyway, so it's humbling. All of it is humbling.
Now, I was really intrigued by the idea of compromise versus finding common ground. He talks a lot about groupish tribalism and the one event that occurs that causes the groups to splinter, and automatically they are evil. And I guess that's something we'll talk about more in the podcast.
All right, so let's try a couple exercises in thinking about this paradigm of the five moral foundations. So in the case of something that's been talked about quite a bit in the last couple of years. You have a family, Mormon family, traditional believing Mormon family, and then they find out that one of their children is gay, has come out to them as gay. So what sort of moral foundations are being shaken? What ones do they run to? I mean, what kind of goes through their moral mind, do you think, as they encounter this this new way to view their child?
The thing that initially comes to mind is the principle, the moral principle of sanctity, because as Mormons, and, well, and as somebody who grew up in the church, you're taught consistently this idea of the law of chastity, and that homosexuality would be a contamination of that principle. And so to me, that seems like that's going to be one of the first things that the family struggles with is, again, the psychology of disgust.
I think there's a couple tension, some tension going on here, because that's the first thing I thought of too. But then at the same time, even conservatives have a great deal of care and fairness going on in their moral psychology. And so caring
and
for their child.
And loyalty.
And loyalty. So they're going to have loyalty.
Yes.
Oh, don't know. That's fine. They'll have loyalty to their family, to their child, and they'll want to make sure their child is cared for and is treated fairly. And so they're going to have this sanctity pulling them one way, and then the loyalty to their child, and not only loyalty to their child, but loyalty to their religion, which is incompatible with this situation. And so they're, it's I can't imagine the tension that a parent might feel in this situation.
I was gonna say something about the loyalty to the different groups, and you covered that. And so there's that loyalty to your group that you go to church with, but loyalty to your family and to your kid. And so there's that conflict there. That what do I have to do to have that loyalty to both groups? What do I do with that? And so that's got to be a major issue to that parent. And but I'm repeating what you said.
Well, right, but so that tension exists? How does that get resolved? You know.
Well, and, you know, just to add to the tension, you know, if I may pull the Sunday school trick for a second, I would like to add on what Brian has said. Well, the individuals themselves have to deal with like what to make of their sexual feelings, right?
Right.
And a really good example of this, at least when it first came out, was Ty Mansfield's book In Quiet Desperation, where you have not only the parents of a homosexual Latter-day Saint who had committed suicide, you also have a homosexual Latter-day Saint himself explaining, you know, what homosexuality can mean to 21st century Latter-day Saints. And, you know, this is really one of the very first times that a homosexual Latter-day Saint had come out and said, listen, I am fully a Latter-day Saint. I will commit myself to a life of celibacy. That being said, I never anticipate my homosexuality leaving. It is really part of who I am. So I would say that book is kind of it's a case study in how people navigate these different moral foundations and try to find some kind of, for lack of better words, middle ground between them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't want to give any of the listeners an impression that we're taking any of these really hard problems and being like, okay, here it is. I mean, obviously this is a huge problem and we're not going to solve anything, but I think it's good to identify the dynamics going on in some of these problems. So using the same terminology of the principles, the five moral foundations, why are we faithful to our spouse as good Mormons? What is it that makes us faithful, where the rest of, not the rest, but a lot of the rest of biological organisms aren't quite so faithful, you might say?
Well, you know, you can argue that marriage is kind of the ultimate tribal act, right? It's the forging of a new clan, and consequently, you know, at least, you know, through Height's reasoning, like there is no better situation in which, you know, to have a very strong relationship with one's partner, because, you know, if you threaten that relationship for any reason, then you're breaking up that tribe. You're breaking up that fundamental unit through which the human brain processes the world. So, you know, by, you know, being unfaithful to one spouse, you know, you're being immensely self-destructive through Hyde's reasoning.
Right, and I would also point out in most religions, and definitely in Mormonism, sexual acts are sacred. or they're considered sacred, or if they're or if they take place out of the wrong in the wrong situations, they are the anti-sacred. And so it's great. It's supporting that moral foundation of sanctity by keeping that, you know, between the two spouses, and as soon as you go out of that, you're violating that very thing that you're keeping sacred.
I think if you keep in mind that sanctity, if you take for granted that is the way you view it, what you just described, Brian, then cheating on your spouse, you can argue that it actually violates just about all five principles, probably with the exception of authority, depending on how you view your marriage. But certainly the other four, it violates all four of them.
I think it violates authority, too, if you look at authority outside your marriage, as far as marriage being consecrated or sanctified by your religion.
Yes, yes, that's true.
So if it's violating all of these, four of these foundations, why does it happen? Why are we not all, I mean, our moral psychology is keeping us from doing this. So what, why does it happen at all then?
I mean, that's $1 million question.
Yeah,
I mean,
right. That's a tremendous question.
When it does happen, it's looked down on so badly, you know, so I don't know. Anyway.
I wonder if it has to do with, you know, the moral foundations. They propose a sixth one, which is liberty and oppression, and I wonder if it would have to do with that, just the idea of kind of rejecting any principle that would dominate you. Being able to do what you want to do, to be free. Maybe we just have a rebellious streak.
And typically, you know, at least in the studies I've seen, you know, you talk to, you know, any person or most people who, you know, commit an act of adultery, you know, if you were to ask them to, you know, walk them through the steps, at some point they feel that the foundations have been have been negatively impacted by the action of the faithful partner, right? So you know, say, so why did you cheat? Well, I felt neglected, right? My wife or my husband didn't care about me, right? Or you know, my wife or husband was spending so much time at work, their loyalty was to the institution of their work rather than to me. It really depends on, you know, where you stand, as they say, depends on where you sit.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing, that usually the person who steps out has justified it somehow, and it's probably true to some degree that the rest of their moral foundations have been attacked by their spouse through loyalty to work or whatever the case may be, not being fair, not treating them well, all of those things. And so it doesn't feel, I imagine, like they are being disloyal because they've already been violated. How important is the anti-sacred, the opposite of sacredness? So for religious people, bringing up the idea that God may not exist, talking about atheists is it brings up the disgust response for very religious people. So what about bringing up the idea of the anti-sacred not existing, like Satan does not exist? How do you think that would affect someone that's religious, or whatever the anti-sacred might be? Is the anti-sacred as important as the sacred, or not quite, or what do you think about that?
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned whatever the sacred might be, because I mean, sacredness isn't particular to religion, though obviously it's, you know, used as a as a word in religious discourse. You know, there are any number of systems in which there are, you know, sacred symbols, right? You know, if you were to, you know, talk to a Marxist, right? The idea of class conflict, it's fundamental. It's not something that can be attacked in any meaningful way. Like, it is how the world works, and anyone who believes otherwise is at best misguided and, you know, at worst, an enemy.
I'm actually working on a post right now of how I lost my testimony of Satan. So I don't know, I'd throw that out there. But yeah, I mean, it's definitely the less important people or religious people don't mind it as much when you lose your testimony, I guess, in Satan, then rather than a god that you worship. In my view.
I remember, though, listening once to, I think it was This American Life, about a preacher who decided that there was no Satan, and it upset all his parishioners so much that they all left. So some people really get it, or actually what he preaches is that there was no hell, which I guess it's the punishment part, which Haidt actually brings up that if you don't have punishment, people don't follow the rules as well.
Yeah, I think in general that's true, and I think that's why in a religious setting you get talks about what it takes to be sent to hell. You know, like lying is thrust; those who lie are thrust down to hell, right? And I think the idea of the anti-sacred, maybe it's not as important as the sacred because you've only taken one part, or not as important for some people. You've only taken one part of their theological framework and taking that away, and maybe that framework is moldable where they can do without Satan, for instance, or without hell, and still be good moral in the sense of being good, be good moral people, where you take away the very center of that, you take away God, that's a lot more difficult to remold and to make useful again. One thing that has bothered me that Jeremy brought up is this fear of going to hell or doing something wrong or being judged or the judgment seat itself. I don't like that teaching because to me it feels like you can do the right things for the wrong reasons or you can do the right things for the right reasons. And I wonder if fear of hell or judgment, to me, that feels like it's the wrong motivation. It's like doing it for the wrong reasons. I'm not quite sure how that fits into the moral foundations. And maybe that just exposes maybe I'm more liberal than I think because I'm not as worried about certain things. I don't know. Does that?
Yeah, I think your care and fairness are showing.
Yeah. So, I think the liberal-minded people would say you should be doing these good things because you care about these other people. And I've had a friend that has, you know, he was a LDS and he's left the church and he was a hardcore atheist for a while, he said, but now he thinks there is some sort of deity out there, some sort of God, but he thinks this God would be more concerned about how he treated his fellow men rather than being afraid of some punishment. He couldn't believe in a God that was punishing, and it's clear from my conversations with him that he's definitely on what you would characterize as the liberal side of the spectrum.
I think fear is a play just because it's just the easiest way to teach somebody something, a principle. You do this, if you don't do that, then hell. And so don't do this because, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the easiest way to teach something is fear, and it's usually most of the time it's the wrong way to teach something, a principle, is out of fear. You don't want to be doing things out of fear. That's just it's the bad thing. Go ahead, Russell.
Well, that's what Paul's morals tell him, that you shouldn't do things out of fear. But someone else might think that, you know, fear of God, that's a good thing. And Pipe talked about, He grew up. He was a liberal, hardcore. Hated Ronald Reagan. He was clearly a liberal, and one of the most extreme liberal movements. He talks about the Occupy Wall Street, and he said he originally liked the idea of it, and then he went and talked to him, and And because they were so focused on being fair and not having an authority figure and being super egalitarian and having no punishments, he lost all respect for them because they couldn't do anything. They couldn't function. And so I think even though maybe I don't care about the fear as much as others, I think teaching that way and having punishment keeps a large group of people in order to some degree, and it keeps us from just, you know, letting everything go and everybody has their own opinion and that's fine, and you know, it keeps the group together and it keeps us functioning, I think, to some degree, maybe a great degree.
And you know, it's noteworthy that early in the Mormon tradition, you know, this fear-based vision of the afterlife, it was dismantled somewhat with the release of Section 76 of the Doctrine and Covenants, in which Joseph Smith said, okay, yes, you know, there is, you know, an outer darkness, but it's something that we don't even need to really worry about too much. I mean, in the Revelation, God is so uninterested in showing Joseph Smith what outer darkness looks like that he showed it to him for a split second, then closed it back up again. So I actually want to talk to you about, you know, the kinds of rewards that are available for people of all different levels of righteousness. So I think that's noteworthy that, you know, even at that early stage, 1832 or so, you know, Mormonism was beginning to say that, you know, that maybe the fear of outer darkness isn't really the way that we should be defining our views of the plan of salvation.
So removing a chunk of that fear from the group, how did, as our resident historian, how did that affect the group?
How did it affect the Latter-day Saints in general?
Right.
You know, according to the research of Grant Underwood, it didn't sink in very well, actually. I mean, there were some who, you know, in today's parlance, we would say that they had to put it on the faith shelf, right? Okay, that's just too weird, because they had been raised with this, you know, this idea that there was a heaven and there was a hell. I mean, for the most part, these folks were, you know, came from Puritan/Protestant backgrounds. So a lot of the Latter-day Saints simply didn't allow this kind of doctrine to influence the kinds of things that they write. Because if you continue to look at Mormon writings for, you know, for the next 10 years or so, you don't see a lot of talk about the three degrees of glory. At least not as much as you would expect.
So you're saying there was some rationalization going on?
I would say there was certainly some resistance going on.
Yeah, the elephant was the elephant and the rider. The elephant kept it going in the way that they wanted it to go.
Yes.
Okay. But I think we still have, I mean, I love Section 76. I think it's a fascinating and beautiful view of the afterlife. But I think some of our leaders definitely reduce it back down to basically a heaven and hell because of the damning between kingdoms idea. And that essentially brings it back down to a heaven and hell where you have to do all this stuff or else, yeah, you'll be in a degree of glory, but eventually you'll stop progressing, you'll get bored, it'll turn into a hell of some sort. At least that's what some people have taken it to its logical end, and therefore it reinforces the fear as part of the motivation in their religious behavior. Reading the A Short Stay in Hell by Stephen Peck is an excellent way to try and grasp the idea of infinity, and those dams between kingdoms really started to bother me after I read that book. I wasn't as comfortable with that idea as I was before.
You know, looking at the TED Talk by Haight, she explained why fear was important, looking at just the groups of organisms in the natural world, how you have parasites or freeloaders, and if there's a punishment that causes them to shrink and go away, and if there's not, they take over, and that's all you have, and it breaks up the group. But that's kind of the lowest common denominator. The other thing I really liked about his TED Talk is he talked about how we all have this staircase within us where we can climb up it, and when we get to the top, ourselves just sort of melt away, and we see the beauty of this unity and oneness of purpose. I mean, Mormon parlance, I think that'd be Zion. So yeah, fear is kind of this base motivation that we need just to exist, but our ultimate goal is to achieve this unity of the Zion.
I think you're onto something there, and I think the fear gets us into doing the things we're supposed to do, and those things that we're supposed to do, if we open our minds, as we read the scriptures, as we ponder in the temple or attending church, and we're doing service for our neighbor, those things are supposed to take us to that elevated state where our motivations start to change, and they're not so much because I have to, but it's because I want to. I have one topic that I'd like to talk about, and it gets to a lot of things that have happened lately and in the news. And I think it would be good to talk about the news, the ordained women movement in general, within this framework of the five moral foundations, because it seems like online in a lot of ways, it's been divided. It's been galvanized, and you have haters hating people that hate them, and the vitriol online is everywhere. Even in family discussion groups, I've heard about people really divided on this. And I think if we think about it's been brought up before, we as human beings, we don't think about facts, and we don't think rationally necessarily. We respond to our perceptions. And so let's talk a little bit about the ordained women movement, because you have some people saying all we're doing is asking, or you know, we're being like Joseph Smith and we're asking these questions, and then the other group doesn't hear that, because they see this as a threat, and so they don't hear the part of all we're doing is asking. So what is it about the movement? What are some ways that maybe things can be reframed to account for what the traditionally believing Mormon is hearing, what they're perceiving? You know, they hear words like feminist, and suddenly all these walls go up in their mind, and we have these stereotypes, and it doesn't, the dialogue doesn't go anywhere. So what are some things to consider in discussing these touchy issues, in particular the ordained women movement?
You know, there are two points that I would make there. First, in regards to why has this been such a divisive issue within the Mormon community? 19th century Mormonism, especially, it shows us a Mormonism in which Mormons are of necessity a tribal people, right? Because they're being kicked around from settlement to settlement, and as the years go on, the saints recognize that if they are going to survive, they need to employ, a circle the wagons mentality. Otherwise, they face real threat of extinction. I mean, they face real threat of death, as they learned in Jackson County. So I think that has, kind of seeped into our cultural and, to a degree, theological DNA, to where we know from, our ancestors' experience passed down to us, that we need to be on the watch for dissenters, right? For factionalization, because that's what leads, in our past to people dying, and in our present, kind of mini apostasies. So that's the first point. As far as why words like feminist kind of throws up so many red flags for people, it's in part because that word has come with so many different connotations, even over the course of the 20th century, right? Because, you could refer to suffragettes as being feminists. You can refer to second-wave feminists. You can refer to third-wave feminists. And they all have different manifestations. And, whereas, if you were to talk about third-wave feminism as such, to a mainstream Latter-day Saint, you have the chance to explain it to them, chances are they would find it, you know, much less subversive than second wave feminism. So feminism has come to mean a very specific thing to Latter-day Saints when it could really mean any number of things, any number of approaches. So those are my thoughts as to, you know, one, why this has been such a divisive issue, and two, you know, why these words like feminists have the kind of reaction that they do within the mainstream Latter-day Saint community.
Anything that challenges the status quo is like challenging the prophets themselves and what they're saying. And challenging that, you're almost saying, this isn't working for me, this true church, this true gospel. It's not working for me. And so to challenge the status quo is like challenging the prophets, and challenging the prophets is like challenging God in our culture. And I think that's where the big, for to me, where the clash happens.
First, I will say that it's hard for me to be objective about this since I am a member of Ordained Women, but I'm going to try. Because mostly everything that you guys are saying is like a punch in the gut. But I can understand the reaction when loyalty and authority become an issue. And you had asked, Brian, how can we approach it in a way to make it less divisive? The problem is, as you alluded to, people tend to not hear what we're saying when they feel affronted. But I think it is to remind people that we have the same loyalties, and that we are not trying to challenge the prophet in a subversive way, but just to get him to ask the questions of the Lord on our behalf. So if there's a way we could frame that to make people understand we are also loyal to the church and to the prophets, and we're not trying to challenge the hierarchy, maybe so much as be a part of it.
I think with the issue of women's ordination, it creates, as Height described, these moral matrices. There's this us versus them mentality where certain groups who are more traditional, conservative, Mormons, are in the mentality like, no, women's ordination is wrong. And then you have those who are in favor of women's ordination, and they exist in two separate groups. And kind of going back to earlier when I was talking about compromise, there was a video, and I believe it was one of the TED, his TED Talks where he talked, no, it's actually the Bill Moyer. I don't know if you're going to link to that. I hope you do, because it's a great discussion. And they show an interview with Senator Boehner, and they're talking about compromise and this idea that you don't compromise with evil. And so I feel that this group of traditional conservative Mormons has marked ordained women as evil, and you do not compromise with evil.
Yeah, I think that's the problem, is it's been labeled as evil, like you say. And, you know, I found ordained women online quite quickly. I might have been even in March where I first found it. And I remember reading through it going, those are some pretty good points that, you know, this isn't the worst thing on the earth. This actually sounds like a good idea. But not everyone has that reaction when they see the name comes out and says, this is what has to happen. And so that's a direct challenge to authority, even though it's just a name to identify the group. But it comes across as a sock to the gut to traditionally believing Mormons, because you're telling the prophet what to do. And then there was this, there's a lot of discussion about equality. And one of the goals, well, I guess the overarching goal of ordained women is to increase the equality, the gender equality in the church, or reduce the gender inequity. And so there's this thread, I think it's on Doves and Serpents, with all sorts of posts called Equality is Not a Feeling. And as I've talked with different family members and women who are not supportive of ordained women, they say, I feel equal. And then you have this thread that says equality is not a feeling. And as I've listened to this height stuff, I tried to think about it more, and we're not looking at facts here. We're not dealing with facts. We're dealing with someone having these feelings and then having another group say, your feelings don't matter or your feelings are wrong, because equality is not a feeling. And so I can understand now how talking about equality and saying there's a problem here when someone has had the feeling of being equal, that's really hard for someone to overcome that gut reaction or the passionate response, you might say, to feel offended, and then therefore their walls all close off. So I think that's something to consider.
And, you know, also, if I may add to this, I think this is where social media actually perpetuates the problems that Height points out rather than resolves them, because it is impossible to convey, you know, the complexity of one's views over a blog post, let alone in a Facebook comment. And that's how a lot of these conversations are taking place. So what ends up happening, and Eric Samuelson in a blog post pointed this out very well, is we are creating caricatures of each other. And this is just a part product of the tribalist thinking that Height points out, where, you know, those who are in the mainstream church, they are portraying ordained women as not merely people who think otherwise, but as, as evil, as the devil, or, you know, as, you know, at best, you know, an apostate group that just doesn't know what's best. And vice versa, you hear other caricatures of, you know, mainstream Latter-day Saint women as, you know, not being fully self-aware, being unenlightened, or what have you. So we see a reciprocity of caricaturizing, and it ultimately leads to the dismantling of the Zion experiment, I would argue.
It's not only that. It's people divide themselves into groups that are like echo chambers, where they come up with all these well thought out rationalizations that define them into a new group, and they insult the other people, and it becomes its own group to itself, to where it can't even communicate with the other side. And yeah, that's depressing to me as well.
It's just so easy to find your echo chamber, though. You know, never in any time period has there been a news channel dedicated to your point of view. You know, you like,
yes,
you're conservative, you got the Fox, you got MSNBC, you got CNN, if you like fake news or stipulation of news. Anyway, but it's just so hard to listen to the other side. You know, you can listen to the conservative side, and, you know, if you're liberal, that's just painful. Your ears bleed. And then if you listen to, you know, Rachel Maddow or whatever, then you're and for the conservatives, you're like, ah, what is this? And so it's just so painful to listen to the other side when it's so easy just to get into that echo chamber and just and not have to deal with it. You know, you're just like, oh, yeah, everyone agrees with me here. Everyone nodding. Yeah, great.
Right. You can ask in self-validation.
Exactly.
One of the podcasts, Jonathan Height was talking with a group of Jews, or they were representative of a larger group of Jews, and there were some that within their congregations, there were some that support the Zion movement and the very pro-Israel positions, and then there are those that are still Jews, but they very much have the opposite feeling. And so, I mean, we're not alone in the world in having our religion divide us. And I mean, they're even similar in that they're a Zion seeking people, literally. And so they have the same problem. And so they asked, how do we deal with this? And Height admits that he doesn't have history as a diplomat, but he gave an idea that I think is pretty powerful, but I think it's more of the long game type solution rather than the silver bullet. And he talked about you have to push these emotional buttons that bring people's guards down, these psychological buttons that bring people's guards down. And he says he never responds to online blog posts because the distance between us through an electronic communication dehumanizes us, and so we don't have our emotional buttons pushed necessarily. So it needs to be face to face. And he says there's something about sharing a meal, there's something about eating food together that shows that we are people, that we are the same, and it humanizes everybody. And so if you share a meal together, and then you bring up a discussion, and when you bring up your points, you're thinking about how the other side might be perceiving what you're saying. So you're not coming out and saying equality is not a feeling or something like that. And he says you need to compliment and you need to apologize. Compliment the other side, apologize for the mistakes that your side has made, and that is how bridges are built. I wish we could point to a study or something that would verify this, but in my mind as he's saying this, I'm thinking that's the only way that it can happen. And when you can convince your friends that are conservative or your friends that are liberal, and you can see that they are human and that they are not stupid and crazy, but they, you know, they're reacting in a very normal way, just like you would to different conversations, then when you see a post online, you're not going to react and write and go on a tirade. And if you see another person being abused online, maybe you would step in and say, hey, and they would recognize, hey, this is a conservative guy protecting these crazy ordained women people. I think that may be the catalyst that's needed to mend the divides that have been created and to build bridges.
And, you know, I really like Haidt's comments about, you know, eating food together, because he argues that this kind of neutralizes our, you know, built-in evolutionary mechanism that tells us, you know, there's not enough resources to go around, and therefore we need to form tribes, and we need to, you know, engage in conflict just to survive. He's saying it kind of demonstrates to us that we do have resources. See, both of us are sitting down eating. You know, there's nothing to fight over here. We are just two people exchanging ideas.
Well, I think, you know, as I've studied these ideas of Jonathan Haidt, I have, you know, I've listened to tons of podcasts and watched the videos, and now I've got both of his books on Kindle, and I'm going to read The Righteous Mind and The Happiness Hypothesis, because I just think there's a ton of wisdom that he's mined out and left for us. So let's leave with some closing thoughts. Maybe one impression or one thing that impressed you from these ideas. And for me, here was this far, far left-leaning liberal who, through his research, he admits was motivated to help the left, to help Democrats do better in politics by understanding the moral psychology. So he forced himself to watch things like Fox News, and he observed them as dispassionately as he could, and he said he felt the anger eventually fall away. And he started to see people like Glenn Beck and Sean Hannity no longer as stupid raving idiots, but as people who have some contribution to make. And he said, as he describes that, he describes it as a spiritual experience, you know, and I would love to have experiences like that, understanding more people around me.
I really liked the social part of it. I liked the fact that we all need to be a part of this group, and this group can do good things, and when we're and also that tragedy can bring us together. I really like that, and it made me more self-aware of others too, listening to these podcasts of how my point of view, how I was raised, how my evolution of, you know, how my genes make me who I am and the decisions I make and the views that I have, that I wasn't a blank slate, you know, at birth. It was an eye-opening thing to me, and how I interact with people is hopefully going to change, where I'll be a little bit more kind in my points of view, hopefully.
I really liked how he said, when he was asked, you know, what do you think we can do to create this more civil conversation? He said he's learned to apologize. And I once saw it written somewhere that political correctness just means learning to say I'm sorry. I think that's true. I think that we can get through to a lot more people if we show humility where we can recognize our mistakes, but that's tricky and I think it takes a lifetime of work.
I think this is kind of going to echo what Paul said, but I think it's really valuable and important to examine why we believe what we believe and why we've reached the conclusions that we have, since we know it's not because of facts. And to remember that when you're facing somebody who believes something in opposition to what you do, it is because they also have based it on their moral foundations. And it's not because they're obtuse, and it's not because they just don't know everything you know. It's because they have a different approach. And it can be valuable if we all come to the table and view each other that way to have a real conversation.
You know, as I was looking over Haidt's work, I couldn't help but think of Fourth Nephi, in which, you know, the Nephites had become so unified that there were no manner of ites. Now, in Haidt's worldview, that would be a lofty goal indeed. So, I would say in some ways, Mormonism, that Zion experiment, you know, it's got some, it has some lofty ambitions. It's even got what you might call some, you know, some chutzpah, right? To dare say that we can ever reach the point where there aren't any manner of ites, or that we've overcome tribalism. So that was my big takeaway, is just how big, the Mormon vision is, especially when juxtaposed against, you know, Haidt's humbling approach.
2 points that Haidt made that really stuck out to me were first, truth emerges when you challenge confirmation bias, and the other being sacrilege is blinding. And so going over his talks and then kind of looking at what I do in my own life, and I come home from work and then pull up like Huffington Post and just going back and seeing what I'm looking at and what I'm spending my time doing. What moral matrix am I putting myself into? And so that was just my biggest takeaway, just being more aware of how much time I'm spending on either side of the spectrum, or particularly on the left side of the spectrum, and navigating more towards the middle.
Yeah. Well, this has been great. Getting a lot of different perspectives. I think we found some great material to learn from, especially as bloggers and people that are interacting online with a lot of people and have the ability to touch a lot of people. Maybe we'll be able to learn from this and do even better than Rational Faith already has, which might be hard to do. Just kidding.
Do it.
Now that's a tall order.
Yeah, that's a tall order. Anyway, this has been a great conversation. I've really enjoyed being on here, guys. Thanks a lot.
Okay. See you guys.
All right, take it easy.
Thanks.
All right, thanks. Take care. Bye.
Thank you. Reach out, touch base.